In this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast, does cholesterol go up on a ketogenic diet? How to maintain your focus during long workouts? Is testosterone bad for your prostate? The latest on NAD, quercetin, and a whole lot more. I have a master's degree in physiology, biomechanics, and human nutrition. I've spent the past two decades competing in some of the most masochistic events on the planet, from SEALFIT Kokoro, Spartan Agoji, and the world's toughest mudder, to 13 Ironman triathlons, brutal bow hunts, adventure races, spearfishing, plant foraging, freediving, bodybuilding, and beyond. I combine this intense time in the trenches with a blend of ancestral wisdom and modern science, search the globe for the world's top experts in performance, fat loss, recovery, gut, hormones, brain, beauty, and brawn to deliver you this podcast. Everything you need to know to live an adventurous, joyful, and fulfilling life. My name is Ben Greenfield. Enjoy the ride. Well, Brock, it's been a little while since we've had an official Q&A episode with me and you. We have a whole lot of new listeners, so you, I will clarify, my podcast sidekick, Brock, who joins me for these Q&A everybody. Sessions.
All you new folks anyway.
Hey. Yeah, that's the rollicking sound of Brock's Canadian voice.
Today.
Since our last Q&A episode session, have transformed myself into a toga donning, Jesus sandal wearing meditative yogi
monk. Do tell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I actually discovered a new form of meditation. Yeah.
You discovered it.
Yeah. I discovered it. I've actually kind of effed around with a whole lot of different forms of meditation. I've taken transcendental meditation.
That's the
courses
one that you do on your teeth, right? The transcendental.
I don't get it. Explain that joke to me.
It's such a dad joke. Yeah.
Oh, dental. That's oh my the gosh. Worst dad joke I'm slow ever. On the uptake.
Sorry, folks.
Yeah, so transcendental, I've, toyed around with all these light sound devices like the Brain Tap and the David Delight Mind Alive, and I'm trying this like new calm thing now, where you tie technology into your meditation, which I'm trying to determine whether or not I actually like. And I've done, mindfulness meditation and Native American sit spots and some of that neurofeedback stuff with the Peak Brain Institute down in LA, which is kind of similar to like the 40 years of Zen that a lot of people talk about, or the bio cybernaut training, which is the other version of that. But what I like is this new form of meditation based on a really fantastic book I read called Mind to Matter, which was written by this fellow named Dawson Church and also a guy named Joe Dispenza. And I'll put a link to that book in the show notes. The show notes are at, where are the show notes, Brock?
They're at bengreenfieldfitness.com/394.
394. Okay, thanks. So the book is called Mind to Matter. Fantastic book about how our emotions affect our biology, but really not presented in that woo of a manner, like actually drawing upon scientific research to show that our brain waves can affect things like epigenetic expression, or our emotions can affect things like the activity of the immune system. And we certainly know this to be true, but the book kind of ties in a lot of the good research. But in the book, kind of couched within the pages, I found this fantastic form of meditation called eco-meditation. Eco-meditation. And they've looked at this for producing different endorphins and neurotransmitters like serotonin and oxytocin. What I like about it is I'm a huge fan of like the shotgun formula, right? Like I kind of like this idea of tapping or EFT, even though a lot of people think it's a little bit fringe and not proven by science. I get something out of it. I've interviewed Nick Ortner. I think his name is, who developed this form of tapping or EFT. And I also am a fan of just pure mindfulness meditation. And then there's also this research done by the Heart Math Institute that looks into directly controlling your heart rate variability by breathing and directing emotions of love and gratitude and peace into your heart center. And that company, HeartMath, even trains you how to affect those around you with your brain's electrical signals and your heart's electrical signals, you know, based on research like how when a jockey walks into a horse stable, the heart rate variability or the heart rate signals of the jockey and the horse kind of align. And you see this in like couples who are in love, etc. So this form of meditation called eco meditation, like does like you do all this during the session. You've got the tapping, you do the coherence, you have the gratitude, you have the just the mindfulness based meditation. It works in breath work, of course, which is another really really good skill to add to your to your skills repertoire. You know, you got nunchuck skills. You've got, what else do we get from Napoleon Dynamite in addition
dancing,
to nunchuck skills?
Dancing and moon
dancing
boots.
Skills. Yes. And then breathing skills and meditation skills. If you want to up your skills, this thing's called Eco Meditation. And I found a place where you could download the whole 21-minute meditation for free. Hopefully we don't crash their servers by announcing this. But I found the free downloadable audio version. I'll link to it in the show notes. But I've just been sitting either in the mornings, at which time it seems to give you a lot of energy for the rest of the day, and also in the evenings, at which time it seems to really enhance my sleep quality, even my deep sleep quality, which is a nut that a lot of people kind of try to crack when it comes to their deep sleep. This thing kind of seems to cover the bases. So I know there's a lot of different ways to meditate. I know there's 8 billion different meditation apps out there, but just the ability to be able to download a simple clunky MP3 and put it on my MP3 player and have no other distractions or apps to toy around with. And I just sit there and do this 21 minute form of eco meditation. I've done it 8 times now in the past month. And I really like it. I like it so much. I'm doing it with my children, with my twin boys this Sunday. I'm going to teach it to them. It's on my calendar to teach it to them this Sunday because I like it so much. I'd like to pass it on to my young ones so that it could become a part of the Greenfield legacy. Perhaps
maybe you can white label it. Can you do that with meditation?
Are you meditating at all?
Yeah, I always do some, you know, I haven't actually bought into any particular brand of meditation because I'm of the mind that you can't really do it wrong as long as you're quieting your mind and spending some time without distractions.
I could think of ways to do it wrong, like with a toaster in a bathtub, for example.
Well, that's just
that could
doing
be the wrong way
wrong,
to meditate.
Really.
Yeah, that's doing
you've
life
got wrong. A lot yeah. more problems yeah. than just not good meditation practice at that point, but yeah, I definitely do meditation pretty much every day.
Okay, well, let's do life wrong a little bit and delve into a whole bunch of science and see how much we can confuse people.
News flashes.
All right, so this is the part of the show where I take a deep dive into a few of the more interesting or compelling items of science or news or research that I think that all of you listening in would find interesting. These are all the things I tend to tweet during the week. You can think of my Twitter account, which you can get at twitter.com/BenGreenfield, is kind of like a portal for all of the interesting studies that I come across.
It's almost like an aggregate.
And the first one,
like an aggregator.
An aggregate. Yes, an aggregate. Okay. Thank you. Yeah, I rely upon Brock for the polysyllabalism in this podcast. So I'm an aggregate. And one of the first things that I found was this idea of a specific molecule that I've been seeing pop up over and over again in kind of the research on anti-aging and longevity. So we know about NAD, right? Everybody's rushing out to get their NAD IVs and their NAD injections and their NAD lip jobs and boob jobs and whatever else you can do with this molecule
what
called
does it stand
NAD,
for again?
Which is actually
a hemorrhagic.
What'd you say?
No.
My turn to get polysyllabic. Nicotinamide adenine there. Dinucleotide. So you've got companies like Thorne and They've got Niacel or True Niagen or Elysium by Basis. There's a lot of companies now using forms of NR, NAD, and then there are a lot of physicians now, of course, administering NAD IVs for those who would want to enhance their mitochondrial health or their overall longevity as a whole, based on the fact that NAD is kind of a crucial part of the mitochondria's electron transport chain. And this study, it was titled Flavonoid Apigenin is an Inhibitor of NADase CD38. I realize that's a mouthful, but yeah, snappy. What NADase is, that's something that would cause a more accelerated breakdown of NAD. So if you could somehow inhibit that protein CD38, then you would allow yourself to have higher levels of just your own endogenous NAD. So what they found was that a couple of interesting molecules actually did a very good job inhibiting NADase. And I like this idea because the two molecules that they looked at also have a host of other protective antioxidant mechanisms in the human body. And one in particular, quercetin, is one that I've been studying up on lately. And it's one of those antioxidant or anti-inflammatory molecules that seems to kind of like hydrogen-rich water or green tea polyphenols induce this protective antioxidant activity without necessarily blunting hormesis, without like blunting your body's ability to, say, you know, be able to build new mitochondria or lay down new muscle fibers in response to a workout. Like, this is an antioxidant you could take post-workout, and it seems to act on a lot of different anti-aging pathways. So quercetin, which in most studies is supplemented in a dose of about 500 to 1,000 milligrams, not a lot more than that. So it actually might cause a little bit of damage. I don't have time to get into that right now, but I've got a physician coming on the show in a few weeks to talk about anti-aging and quercetin and some of these other molecules and where the law of diminishing returns or damage might actually come in with especially with a lot of these antioxidants, like resveratrol and quercetin, and there's another very popular one called taro stilbene. But anyways, quercetin at about 500 milligrams to 1,000 milligrams seems to induce a lot of benefits, including this ability to be able to regulate mitochondrial NAD levels, and also what's called sirtuin activity. Like, sirtuins is what you get from dark chocolate and blueberries and red wine and all these kind of dark purpley blue, dark red foods that we'd find in nature. And quercetin is one that has some really good action. And the other one that they looked at in this study was apigenin. Have you ever heard of apigenin?
No.
Yeah, it's a color compound. It naturally occurs in plants, and you find it in things like parsley. It's in high amounts of parsley, chamomile tea, sprouts, like green sprouts. Those are really high in apigenin. Onions have a decent amount of apigenin. And apigenin also has a lot of good research behind it for decreasing inflammation, for having a little bit of a neuroprotective effect. It might lower cortisol. I'm not convinced that it's one that would need to be supplemented with, as opposed to just like eating a lot more plants and some of these, you know, like doing something like, you know, green sprouts every day with your salad, or having a cup of chamomile tea, or along with the green sprouts on your salad, you know, using a good dose of parsley. But anyways, apigenin and quercetin seem to really act on these NAD pathways quite effectively, which is good news for anybody who's kind of looking into anti-aging molecules, or who perhaps is very interested in this whole infatuation with NAD but wants to take, you know, the most natural route possible. So it was a cool study, a relatively new one, and I do not, by the way, at this point in my life, supplement with quercetin. But I am very interested in beginning to do so based on some of this research that I'm now seeing on it, as well as the research study that I'm about to get into. So Thorne actually has a decent brand of quercetin that I'll link to in the show notes. But I'm on the cusp of ordering that, beginning to kind of add quercetin into my anti-aging protocol as just something I take on a daily basis, or at least cycle in throughout the year.
So the supplementation would be the way to go, because you'd have to eat like a ridiculous amount of parsley, wouldn't you, to get the – the dosage that's efficacious?
Well, that's apigenin. That's apigenin is the one that you'd get from like the parsley and everything else. Quercetin you would find in apples, onions, red wine has some. Green tea is a decent source of quercetin as well. And then berries. Berries are very good. One thing that kind of flies under the radar, but it's a lesser known tea called buckwheat tea that actually has a lot of quercetin in it as well. Do not worry. It says wheat, but that's not like you're drinking gluten. Buckwheat tea, I believe, is relatively gluten free.
Celiacs
for those of you who are. Yeah, for those of you who are orthorexically afraid of gluten. But anyways, buckwheat tea is another one. But quercetin is not in extremely high amounts in terms of like the dosages they would use in these studies in some of those compounds. So it's one that if you're looking for the full-on anti-aging and longevity effect, you'd supplement with.
Gotcha.
It's silly to eat plants. Jeez, who needs plants in this era of capsules and powders and pills?
True.
Yeah.
No, it's not.
No, I like both. I like to eat my whole foods, but then also for the stuff that you need a little bit of extra for better living through science, you throw some of those into the mix. But this other study on quercetin that I'll also link to in the show notes looked at the effects of quercetin on eccentric exercise-induced muscle damage, which is, and that's the type of muscle damage that would, of course, result in soreness. And in this study, they used about 1,000 milligrams a day and compared it to a placebo in a randomized double-blind crossover control study. What they found was that just a couple weeks of quercetin supplementation seemed to kick in and be able to significantly attenuate the muscle weakness that you get after a workout, particularly the muscle weakness caused by eccentric muscle damage. And in sports science, this is called myofibrillar disruption. And also there's impairment of what's called your sarcolemmal action. And all you need to think about this as is when you've worked out hard, when you've lifted weights the next day, let's say you're going to go play basketball or tennis, or you're going to go roll and do some jiu-jitsu, or you've got some other sport that you're going to compete in, and it almost feels as though you're not able to move, you know, from a biomechanical standpoint as effectively. Well, a lot of that is due to that muscle damage and that myofibrillar disruption, and due to the sarcolemmal damage, some of the inability to be able to get your nervous system to call upon muscles in the way that they're supposed to. And it appears that quercetin kind of protects you from a lot of these issues. But like I mentioned when I was talking about that other study, it doesn't, if you were to take it post-workout, seem to inhibit your ability to be able to build new mitochondria or to build new muscle in response to that workout. So I would say that, you know, as part of like an anti-aging protocol or as part of a post-workout soreness protocol, somewhere in the range of 500 to 1,000 milligrams of quercetin seems to be a really cool strategy. You know, and again, this might not be something you do every day, but let's say you're doing like a weight training workout 2 or 3 times a week, you could add in kind of like your post-workout supplement stack something like quercetin. So there you have it. And quercetin, by the way, for those of you who haven't heard of this before, don't know, it's quercetin. That's quercetin. And then that other one that I mentioned, apigenin, that's apigenin. So I thought those are some pretty interesting takeaways, and I'm seeing more come out about quercetin these days. The book, by the way, that I mentioned and the doc I'm going to get on the show is the Kaufman protocol, why we age and how to stop it. So if you guys want to delve into that book, it's I don't recommend you buy the Kindle version. I bought the Kindle version, and the way that it's packaged is like for some reason the Kindle version looks like a very hard to read PDF on your Kindle device. So buy the actual real paperback version if you're going to get it. But that book is very interesting and also discusses quercetin.
And
so that's the Kaufman protocol.
Just because I know there's going to be some very smart folks out there that want to give this a try, it looks like in the study they took the quercetin after the workout at breakfast and then another dose of it 12 hours later. So if anybody wants to give this a try.
So, 2 500-milligram doses. Yep, exactly. Yeah,
I know people are going to be clamoring to give it a shot. So there you go.
Yeah, and while we're talking about plants, this is another interesting one that Dr. David Perlmutter was recently discussing, and I looked up the study, and it's very interesting. This one is about exosomes. Now, I have gotten some publicity for exosomes because I've had them injected into, you know, all the different joints of my body and my face and infused into my bloodstream because it's a cell signaling molecule that, especially when co-administered with stem cells, essentially upgrades your stem cells. It enhances their ability to be able to communicate with other cells or to travel throughout the body. And so, you know, one of the more popular forms of exosomes is produced by this company called Chimera Labs. And a lot of doctors will use that form of exosomes as kind of like an anti-aging protocol and also as a joint repair protocol. But this study looked at the gut microbiota and particularly the intake of wild plant matter. You know, things like parsley or cilantro or thyme or rosemary or nettle or mint would all be very good examples of the type of plants that could do this. But these plants contain exosomes or what are called exosome-like nanoparticles, and these get taken up by your gut microbiota, and they actually contain RNA that alters your own physiology, meaning that you can think of this as if you're almost like eating your own exosomes, because these things serve as cell signaling molecules, very similar to this idea of like getting exosomes from something like Chimera Labs, you know, injected in your bloodstream or using a joint. Again, I'm not saying this would replace something like a stem cell protocol or an anti-aging, you know, injection protocol. But again, in combination with something like that, it could be a very, very good way not only to influence the health of the gut, you know, because we know that these wild plants can induce what's called xenohormesis, which makes your cells stronger and can allow your gut to repair in a very robust manner, especially when they're not overdone, right? Not like boatloads of kale, but, you know, kind of used as a condiment in your foods and your salads, with your cooking, with your meat, etc. And it's based on this concept of microRNAs. Now, I have a whole section on microRNAs in the new book that I'm working on, because they're very interesting. MicroRNAs can actually influence your emotions, your character development, the expression of certain genes. It appears that they're also transmitted via saliva, via breath, via urine. And so there's even some hypotheses that when you look at like a married couple who have been married a long time, and you kind of look at a sequence of photographs from their early days of marriage to their later days of marriage, and it kind of sort of looks like they're looking more the same, like the couple, like, you know, that the husband and the wife develop some similar facial characteristics and physical characteristics. Some of that might be due to the exchange of microRNA in saliva when they're kissing, or the exchange of microRNA in the breath when they're living together. And so if you're listening in and you haven't kind of looked into microRNA and you find this kind of stuff fascinating, just Google microRNA, because it's very cool what these things are capable of. And it appears that the consumption of wild plants is a very good way to introduce them into the gut. So one last thing I should mention for this study is the main one that they used in this study was ginger, which you could consider to be another kind of like wild plant extract or root extract. So that's the deal with eating plants. It actually influences your microRNA, which could influence your genome, which could give you more exosomes, and which can influence your gut microbiota.
Score another one for wild plant matter.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Another one for salads. Another one. Another strike against a strict carnivore diet, I suppose.
Oh, yeah. Oops. Sorry, folks.
Yeah. I caught a lot of flack on that Joe Rogan episode I was on for talking about the carnivore diet and some of its potential failings. And, you know, I stand by most of my words. I think I mentioned that it was lazy, and I should have said that it was just kind of like excessively restrictive.
It's reductionist.
Not lazy, because, yeah, it's very reductionist. And I think, you know, if you were to do a carnivore diet, just at least have some like green sprouts and a few little wild plant extracts and some rosemary and thyme along with those ribeye steaks, and you'll fill in a few of those bases.
Yeah. So, anything that's so restrictive, just it doesn't even stand reason that would be the best way for us to eat. Like, just millions of years on this planet. And yeah, we're built to be omnivores.
Yeah, and you know, I guess one other thing I should say about the carnivore diet is one of the things that is very interesting is a lot of people say, like, the Inuits and several Native American tribes and the Maasai tribes in Africa, they eat a strict carnivore diet. But when you look at, you know, like the Maasai or the Samburu or any of these tribes from East Africa, yeah, they eat meat and blood as a primary component of their diet. But when you look at a lot of their warriors and their young men, they're also eating herbs and tree roots. Barks. And a lot of the women and the older men, they eat a significant amount of fruit and tubers and raw honey. You look at the Inuit, and yeah, they're eating walrus and whale meat and seal and fish, but they also are foraging wild berries and sea vegetables and even fermenting many of these plant foods to kind of preserve them for when they might not be able to hunt them down when they're not growing. Or you look at these Native American tribes like the Sioux tribes. You know, they would eat buffalo meat, but while they're foraging the buffalo meat, you know, they're eating wild fruit and nuts and seeds as they're tracking down these buffalo herds. You know, the nomadic tribes of Mongolia are another tribe where, you know, they're often called out as a tribe that's carnivorous, but they're also eating, you know, dairy, which is important for the vitamin K and the vitamin A that you might not get high amounts of on a carnivore diet. And they're also eating wild onions and garlic and tubers and roots and seeds and berries. So even these populations that are identified as supposedly, you know, carnivorous ancestral populations, they're also eating plants and tubers and honey and leafy greens. And so, you know, I agree, Brock. I mean, there's just not a whole lot of evidence of long-lived, not just long-lived carnivorous populations, but long-lived strict vegan populations or long-lived keto populations, right? Like, any of these reductionistic, dogmatic diets don't seem to manifest themselves in terms of populations who have followed those diets and been around for a really long time.
Boom.
So, yeah, it is good for selling diet books on Amazon.
It really, really is.
So, yeah. Yeah. There was also a really cool article that I read on a blog, and it dug into some of the epidemiological research on the consumption of vegetable oils. And this one, I mean, the takeaway from this ultimately is if you are eating a high intake of PUFAs, polyunsaturated vegetable oil, especially like processed rancid vegetable oil, and going out into the sun, you are actually increasing your risk for damage from UVA and to a lesser extent UVB radiation. And they dug into a whole bunch of different studies on different populations and skin cancers and the use of PUFAs. You know, in particular, one fascinating takeaway was from New Zealand sailors. And what they found was that as margarine and vegetable oils began to replace things like butter and coconut oil and even like lard and beef and lamb drippings and a lot of these more ancestral fats, there was a significant increase in these soldiers who were spending a long time in the sun in skin cancer and melanoma development. And then this article goes on to identify a lot of the skin repair mechanisms that are inhibited by a high PUFA diet, and also the increase in radiation damage that can occur when you have a lot of these oxidized oils in your body. I mean, like, the worst thing you could do is go eat French fries or fried chicken or even, you know, even like battered fish on the beach and then go out in the sun. Like, it like is actually horrible for your skin versus eating like butter or cheese or full fat yogurt or fatty fish or like a good avocado oil based mayonnaise or lard or ghee or any of these more very natural forms of highly stable fats that are often somewhat solid at room temperature. They have a protective mechanism for the skin, whereas these PUFAs seem to actually spell bad news bears, especially if you're going to be out in the sunshine. Isn't that interesting?
Is. That's, I'm just thinking, what if you rubbed that piece of fish and chips on your skin instead of ingesting
it? Yeah, I think it would make it even worse because then you've got oxidized oil on your skin. You know, which is a mouth that is a, you know, the skin is a delivery mechanism for many drugs and pharmaceuticals and supplements. And so, yeah, probably not a good idea. Whereas you know, we know that a lot of these more stable fats are not only protective, but there are other things that you can do, especially from an antioxidant standpoint. It's the same idea of returning to the ribeye steak, right? Like cook your ribeye steak with rosemary and thyme, or cayenne pepper or turmeric, or a lot of these protective antioxidants that reduce the form of carcinogens in the meat. And do the same for your body when you're heating it up, right? Like don't just, you know, make sure you've got lots of good healthy fats coming in, but also try to consume a lot of natural antioxidants. I mean, not only things like I was talking about before, like quercetin or some of these apigenin-rich plants, but another one is astaxanthin. Astaxanthin is what fish consume primarily from, I believe they're getting astaxanthin.
From algae?
From
algae?
What's that? Yeah, it's found in algae, but it's like this pink red colored substance. It's technically a carotenoid, but I think it's krill that is another thing that fish eat that it has that contains astaxanthin. Algae is another, and then shellfish have a lot of astaxanthin. But like a good fish oil will be packaged with astaxanthin. Or there are companies like there's one in Hawaii, and I used to consume, I think it was somewhere in the range of 10 milligrams of astaxanthin prior to my Ironman Hawaii competitions, because they always used to have this stuff at the expo down in Kona. And once I started doing that, my skin was not as burnt after, you know, 10 hours out in the Hawaiian sun. So astaxanthin, you know, of all the different forms of almost like edible sunscreen, is probably the highest in terms of something you could consume along with really good fats to offer you protective or protection against the sun. And then the other thing that I would also recommend is anytime you're consuming like fish oil, I would consider like a really good antioxidant, like not just vitamin E or vitamin C, but something more natural like astaxanthin along with the fish oil. So I'll link to that article also over at bengreenfieldfitness.com/394, along with one other about sunscreen. Did you see this Outside Magazine article on sunscreen being the new margarine?
Yeah, well, there is or the new cigarettes. There was a line in there that I thought was really, let's see if I can find it.
What the study gets into is, well, it starts off with vitamin D and how vitamin D supplementation is something that seems to have failed in a lot of clinical trials. And part of that might be due to, you know, folks like me who have genetic issues that don't allow us to get as much vitamin D from sunlight as we can. Some of it might be due to the fact that vitamin D supplementation is often something that's done in the absence of all the other fat-soluble vitamins like A and E and K that can allow the vitamin D to become more bioavailable. But then part of it too is likely due to the excess use of sunscreen when people are getting out in the sun. And this article goes into some very interesting long-term studies that look into the effects of sunlight on lowering blood pressure, reducing all-cause risk of mortality, reducing the risk of prostate, breast, colorectal, and pancreatic cancers, sunlight improving virtually every mental condition you can think of, reducing inflammation, dampening autoimmune responses, and how slathering sunscreen on your skin not only keeps a lot of those mechanisms from happening, but there's actually a lot of evidence now that people who use sunscreen every time they go out in the sun can have a significantly increased risk of skin cancer. And that's probably due to all of these oxybenzones in the sunscreen, which can mutate the DNA when applied to the skin. A lot of the other endocrine disruptors, the phytoestrogens that are found in a lot of these sunscreens. So, you know, I've always kind of stood by the idea of using sunscreen as minimally as possible, using something like astaxanthin before you go out in the sun for long periods of time, and then just educating yourself on natural forms of sunscreen that you can use. You know, and there's some really good information on the website for the Environmental Working Group over at EWG.org. And they have some great sunscreen articles on there and a lot of data about the nanoparticles and the hormone-disrupting elements in sunscreen. But what I like even more is they've identified a host of actual healthy sunscreens. You know how many sunscreens there are out there that actually meet EWG's criteria, that aren't like slathering a bunch of chemicals on your skin, that offer you some amount of skin or you know, protection from excess UVA and UVB damage, but that don't cause you all the issues with a, you know, the average sunscreen that you'd grab from the grocery store.
I think there's more than there was maybe 2 or 3 years ago, but still not very many, I'm guessing.
No, there's actually a lot.
Is there?
There's 243 different products from like Toms of Maine to, you know, to Sun Tribe to Badger. All these companies now. I mean, there's a lot. So I mean, just freaking go. I'll link to the Environmental Working Group's list. I mean, there is absolutely no excuse that you should not be using natural sunscreen. By the way, I don't know why we're talking about this in the middle of the winter, but anyways.
Well, I am going to Hawaii in 2 weeks, so I could use this advice.
Yeah. Huh? Yeah, I'll be going to Hawaii in a few weeks as well to hunt. And again, like, I don't use sunscreen. I do use natural plant-based antioxidants. And then if I am going to do something dumb and just, like, you know, put on my Speedo and go spearfish for 3 hours, or, you know, like back in the day, do an Ironman triathlon, I'll use a sunscreen, but I'll either use something like, you know, coconut oil, which has a natural SPF, I think, of around like 6, something like that, or else I'll just use one of these natural sunscreens that would meet EWG's criteria that you can get from the website. We used to make our own, but it's a pain in the ass, like, honestly. It's like you got to do you got to cook, and you got to, you know, get yourself zinc oxide and titanium oxide and coconut oil and all these other elements. It's almost just as easy to buy. So as cool as it feels going all hippy dippy and making sunscreen in your kitchen, honestly,
right next to your kombucha and your yogurt station.
Exactly. Too much. So anyways, I hope that's helpful for folks. And what I'll do is, in the show notes, if you go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/394 for everything discussed in today's news flashes, I'll give you guys links to that, like that Eco Meditation podcast and some of these books, some of the quercetin I talked about, and some other things that'll be helpful for you. You'll find those in the news flashes section near the top of the show notes.
Hi, Ben. My name is Tom. I'm a 45-year-old ultra runner from England. In May, I'll be taking part in a 264-mile ultra marathon in Wales called Cake or Death. I'll probably be doing this without a support crew, and I wondered if you could recommend anything to help me combat the inevitable cognitive decline that occurs in events of this length. There are sleep stations at miles 80, 140, and 200, and I will be looking to take advantage of these. Thank you very much for your time. I look forward to hearing from you.
You know what I think is probably the toughest part about this ultra marathon that Tom is doing is the fact that there are opportunities to sleep. Because the hardest thing about doing any of these events is sleeping and then somehow forcing yourself to wake up and keep going.
Yeah, you just have to just not even think about it. Just get up and go. Or just don't sleep.
When I've done some of these 3 or 4 or 5 day events, like I didn't sleep. I couldn't, and I didn't want to, because I didn't want to just down regulate my amped up nervous system. So I just wouldn't sleep. Like even that Spartan Agoji, where we had opportunities with our sleeping bags and our bivvies, like I didn't sleep. I just stayed up, tended the fire. I've always found that for these longer events, if I sleep, the same thing have like at World's Toughest Mudder, I decided to crawl into the tent for like a quick cat nap at like mile 45. Yeah. And I was cold. I fell asleep, curled up next to my wife who was crewing for me in our tent. And, you know, I think I crawled in there at like 2 a.m. I woke up at 4 a.m. and I was like, screw that. And I did go back out there, but I only did like, I think I did like 14 more miles.
Yeah,
that was
just
it.
Just
zapped after you sleep. So careful with that sleep. You know, I know you plan to take advantage of them, but I would tell you just push through and sleep at the end. But anyway, so the cognitive decline. Well, you've got a while to train for this between now and May. So there are some cool tricks that you can use, and I would start by training your mind like you would train a muscle. And this is very useful for anybody listening in, not even folks who are just going to do a crazy ultra marathon in Wales, but anybody who wants to improve their focus, their attention span, reduce symptoms of things like ADD or ADHD. There's some very cool tricks that you can use. So one would be something that we've already alluded to, and that would be begin meditating. I mean, they've done studies, one very interesting study that involved an 8-week course of meditation where after 8 weeks, and this was, you know, decent N size, I think they had like 140, 150 folks in this study, they saw a measurable, very significant improvement in attention span after just 10 to 20 minutes of meditation performed over the course of 8 weeks. So I would, as much of a disconnect that seems to be between like going out and running a marathon and meditating, I think that meditating is a very good tactic, especially for endurance athletes and focus and attention span. Another one is memorization. They've shown that brain training games can boost attention levels when you play things like Lumosity, yes, or Brainscape, yeah, or things like that. But all they seem to boost your attention levels for are those actual games themselves. Like, you get better at that actual game. But there is one type of app or game that you can use that does seem to cross over to other cognitive challenges. And you can get this for free in the App Store. It's called N1 training, or N-back training. And this involves basically seeing a number or a color or a letter or some other form of a cue, and then going through a few cycles where you're shown other numbers or letters or signals or colors or cues, and then you have to recall the signal that appeared, you know, one instance ago, or as you get better at the game, two instances ago, or three instances ago, and you can work it all the way up to being able to remember whatever signal appeared like 10 cues back. And it's free. It's simple to figure out. But that's another one that, if you do consistently between now and May, can also improve your attention span or your time span. I realize this isn't strength and conditioning. This is just mind training. But you can think of it as like strength conditioning for your mind.
It goes hand in hand.
I would do those. Another one would be neurofeedback. You know, there's the Peak Brain Institute in LA, which I mentioned early in this podcast, that I've gone down to and done a qEEG brain scan at, identified areas in the brain that have, for example, excess beta brainwave, distractibility style brainwave production, and they use neurofeedback to fix that, meaning that you hook up electrodes to your head, which monitor your brainwaves, and any time that your brain kind of strays into a distracted state or a state of say, excess beta brainwave production, what happens is any game that you happen to be playing at the time, because you'll play spaceship games or race car driving games or what have you, you'll actually kind of get a subconscious slap in the wrist, like your car will slow down or the ignition will stop coming out of the spaceship or the music will stop playing. And this can actually passively train your brain to become focused. I thought it was gimmicky when I first heard about it. Then I went and did it. And I did it for 3 months. I actually went down to Peak Brain Institute. I bought some of their equipment. I took it back. I trained with it. And then I went back down for a follow-up qEEG, and all of my scores were off the charts. But in addition to that, I would experience things like, you know, walking into a cocktail party, I used to get distracted by all the different conversations occurring, right? Like, I could just like hear 10 different conversations and would kind of not be able to focus on what the person right in front of me was saying. That all just melted away after this neurofeedback, and it significantly improved focus. So, you know, train your mind like you would train a muscle when it comes to preparing yourself to stave off that cognitive decline that would occur during that event. So I would recommend that, and then we could also turn to the world of like nutraceuticals or supplements. And probably the ones that I think work best is any wakey-wakey type of supplements. Like when I did Kokoro, which was about, I think that was about 72 hours of just beat down and no sleep and, you know, ocean and burpees and 26-mile night hikes. And I'll link to a whole article that I wrote about that event and how to prep for it. I actually just slipped some no-dose caffeine tablets in one pocket, and then I had some theanine. And you can combine caffeine with theanine to take some of the edge and the jitteriness and the heart rate racing off of the caffeine. So if you do, like, let's say 200 milligrams of caffeine, about a 2-to-1 ratio can work well. So you take around 100 milligrams of theanine. Both of those are available in supplemental form. And I would do that. And then I also use this, and this is very good also for stabilizing your hormones and for lowering some of the cortisol during exercise. I took this Chinese adaptogenic herb blend. I was popping 2 a day. Called Tian Chi, and I would just open the packet and dump it into my mouth and chase that with a squirt of water from a water bottle or a canteen. And between the no-dose tablets combined with the L-theanine and then also doing some Tian Chi, my nervous system was really at the ready, but I didn't feel like I was just like jittery or that I was getting like a come-down crash after the no-dose caffeine tablets. So the reason you do that is like there's no time to make a cup of coffee at these events, but caffeine is a very good aid. If I could go back and do it again, I would even consider like chewing some nicotine gum during that event, or doing any long-term event, just because that seems to be able to maintain alertness and focus for longer periods of time as well. You just need to be aware that in some people can kind of make your heart race a little bit. So that would be kind of like the stack would be no-dose caffeine with L-theanine, and then throw in some Tian Chi if you can. And I'll link to all this in the show notes. And then nicotine would be another one I would consider throwing into the mix. And then you should also consider the fact that when you look at central nervous system fatigue, it's very interesting because what happens is there are exercise-induced changes in serotonin, in dopamine, in noradrenaline. And a lot of these things, most notably tryptophan, they can cross into the blood-brain barrier. And what you can see is almost like a lethargy that develops as a lot of these compounds cross the blood-brain barrier. And one of the main issues that can cause this fatigue to occur is a drop in blood levels of amino acids, because there's nothing to compete with tryptophan to cross that blood-brain barrier. And so if you were to consume amino acids, like essential amino acids, during a long event, and this is what I began to do in 2013 when I was racing Ironmans, and I found it to be incredibly effective at a dosage of 5 to 10 grams per hour, you can stave off the central nervous system fatigue. Because in many cases, people think that when they get lethargic or feel almost like hypoglycemic or sleepy during very long exercise sessions, it's not an exhaustion of your carbohydrates. It's instead a buildup of some of these amino acids or neurotransmitters in the brain that can lead to excess fatigue. So you fight that by just slow bleeding amino acids into your bloodstream during exercise. I think that in a case like this, branch chain amino acids can actually work and have been shown to work in terms of staving off central fatigue. But the problem is that even though they're cheaper and they're easier to get, they also do not help with things like preventing excess muscle breakdown. They don't seem to offer the same type of ergogenic sports performance aid as something like essential amino acids do. And I've compared both. I used the BioSteel BCAAs for a while when I was racing, and then I switched to EAAs, or essential amino acids. I found essential amino acids to be far more effective. So, I mean, I don't want this to be like a commercial for aminos, because I, you know, I own a company that makes amino acids, but I would definitely consider using something like an amino acid supplement or essential amino acid supplement. And then the other final thing that I would consider, because it's a preferred fuel for the liver, for the heart, for the diaphragm, it allows for very stable mental function during exercise, and that would be the use of exogenous ketones. I have a whole article called How to Get into Ketosis, and it's all focused on how like the best blends of nutrients for especially endurance athletes to use during exercise, and either ketone salts or ketone esters are a huge part of that. So I would consider the use of essential amino acids stacked with ketones, some of those central nervous system stimulants, and then I don't want to get into something that I already have for free on an article that you can just read, but I also list what you'd use for carbohydrate and what you'd use for fats during an event like that, and you can go read the article that I'll link to in the show notes to kind of take an even deeper dive. But those are a few of my basic tips for maintaining focus and staving off central nervous system fatigue during these long, long-ass workouts.
I'm a 60-year-old man, and I've been paleo for about 5 years. I tried keto recently, and my cholesterol went from 280 to 350, and my LDL from 180 to 250. My triglycerides are low. My blood sugar is low. My CRP is very low. My question is, was I better off on paleo?
You experienced any issues with cholesterol on a high-fat diet, Brock, or have you tested that or messed around with it at all?
I have, and I'm in the same boat as Glenn. My LDL and my overall cholesterol, actually everything except for triglycerides, went way up when I even experimented with keto. And I have that gene. I have that, what is the ApoE1? Something like that.
You mean familial hypercholesteremia?
Yeah, yeah. Or? Yeah, I've got the gene for that. So really, I just had to switch from saturated fat to, like, just avoid the saturated fat. I could keep my monounsaturated.
So you're MUFAs. You were eating more Mediterranean-style fats instead of... Okay, got it. Got
more,
it.
More coconut oil and less butter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, more coconut oil, more extra virgin olive oil, more avocado oil. Yeah. More of your Mediterranean fats versus a lot of these very solid brick fats, you know, and one could argue even coconut oil has a higher amount of the saturated, and you could even, basically you'd want to just take a lot of those fats that are solid at room temp. And I realize this might fly in the face of what I was saying earlier about sunscreen and sun damage, but what I'm getting at is that if you do have something like a gene that would cause very high cholesterol or an inflammatory response to the high intake of saturated fats, then that would be a situation in which you actually should shift towards very stable Mediterranean fats and have only like 10% of your total fat intake come from some of these more saturated fats. But going back to Glenn's question, it is not uncommon for LDL and cholesterol to skyrocket on a ketogenic diet, especially if you're not an incredibly active athlete or especially an endurance athlete. And I'll get into why I would say that in a moment here. But high cholesterol on a ketogenic diet is, first of all, not necessarily something that is inherently bad. Like, we know that cholesterol serves a number of important roles in the body. Yeah. It's a critical structural element in tissues like the brain or the nervous system. It's one of those things that acts as a transport molecule to shuttle fat-soluble nutrients into cells. It's a building block for progesterone and estrogen and testosterone and cortisol and vitamin D. And there's very little evidence that cholesterol in and of itself is something that would increase your risk for cardiovascular disease or heart damage or cholesterol buildup in the arteries. And, you know, in fact, cholesterol buildup in the arteries is simply a sign that inflammation is present, and the cholesterol buildup in the arteries is a protective mechanism. There's a study called the Framingham Heart Study that was done in Framingham, Massachusetts, that monitored a group of over 5,000 people for heart disease risk factors. And that study's been ongoing since 1948. I mean, there's a lot of longitudinal data from that study, and they showed that over 40% of heart attacks occur in people with desirable cholesterol levels, like lower than 200, and having a total cholesterol lower than 180 can triple your chances of suffering from a stroke. They also showed total cholesterol levels below 200, which is, again, the range that's considered desirable by the American Heart Association. That's associated with poor cognitive function in old age compared to people who have borderline high or even high, like 240-plus cholesterol. And so there's a host of data that shows that cholesterol can have a highly cardioprotective effect and can also increase intelligence, increase, you know, your endocrine function. And when you look at LDL, which is one that does tend to go up in many cases on a ketogenic diet, you know, it's really, when you're looking at LDL, one of those situations where if you're getting a lipid test or looking at a lipid panel, it's the type of LDL that you need to look at, not the total LDL count. You know, what matters is the particle size, because there's two different kind of patterns for LDL. One's pattern A and one's pattern B. So pattern A is usually a larger particle size, right? And these tend to carry more fat-soluble nutrients. They tend to carry more antioxidants, pattern A, LDL. And so they're highly cardioprotective. And then you look at pattern B, LDL, and that's a very small particle size. It's a lot more prone to oxidation, especially if you also have high blood sugar. It's small enough to enter into the endothelial lining of the artery, where it's more likely to be oxidized and more likely to form plaque. And there is a high association between pattern B, LDL, and cardiovascular disease. So you also need to pay attention to your pattern. But I should note that studies have shown that a ketogenic diet reduces the number of pattern B LDL particles and increases the number of pattern A LDL particles. So when you're looking at your lipid panel, you need to get a lipid panel, like a full lipid panel that looks at both pattern A LDL and also pattern B LDL. And then, of course, HDL is another one that you should pay attention to, particularly what's called your HDL to triglyceride ratio, because high levels of triglyceride in the blood are often a byproduct of insulin resistance. They're often something that can indicate excess energy consumption. And when paired with low HDL, that's a risk factor. So you need to look at not just the pattern of your LDL, but also your HDL to triglyceride ratio. So finally, if your LDL or your cholesterol is elevated, you should make sure that you don't have chronic inflammation. Like, you should test your inflammation, make sure that if you're on a ketogenic diet and cholesterol is high, that inflammatory elements, particularly things like HSCRP or fibrinogen or cytokines or homocysteine, that these are all low. Like, that would be an ideal scenario. But generally what you see in a well-structured ketogenic diet in the absence of inflammation is you get increased LDL particle size because there's less oxidation from high sugar throughput. You get increased HDL because you need that to recycle LDL from the blood before it has a chance to become oxidized. You get a better lowering of triglycerides and an improved triglyceride to HDL ratio. Like, so all of these things are technically favorable under most circumstances. Now, there are some other reasons, though, that you might have high cholesterol on a ketogenic diet that you would want to pay attention to. And I would say there's five things that you'd want to look at. One would be your actual thyroid conversion. So the active version of thyroid, which is T3, that activates the LDL receptors on your cells. And if your thyroid is dysregulated, or if you're consuming foods that you have an autoimmune reaction to, like in many cases, they'll be like wheat or soy or dairy. If you have liver or if you have gut issues, you know, if you're restricting your carbohydrates to such an extent, especially when combined with heavy exercise, that your thyroid is downregulated, you might not be able to activate LDL receptors and your LDL might skyrocket to and you'd also notice a change in the pattern of that LDL to pattern B type LDL. So that would be one thing to pay attention to, would be your thyroid. So if your cholesterol is high, check out your thyroid. Inflammation, I already mentioned. And so if your LDL is high, make sure that you don't have very high levels of inflammation, which can oxidize those LDL particles and damage the arterial walls. And technically, it signals the manufacture of more cholesterol to heal those damaged cells, so you get an increased risk of plaque formation. So pay attention to inflammation. Pay attention to thyroid. Another one that you'd want to pay attention to that I already mentioned is your HDL levels. And in many cases, you'll see low HDL on a ketogenic diet in people who are not eating enough plant matter or who are not consuming enough fiber on that ketogenic diet. So that's why I'm a big fan of like a plant-rich approach to a ketogenic diet, not just putting, you know, like butter in your coffee and, you know, spoonfuls of coconut oil. Another thing that can increase cholesterol in a very extreme fashion when you're on a ketogenic diet is if you're combining a ketogenic diet with a lot of caloric restriction that causes rapid weight loss, because what happens is your adipose tissue will begin to mobilize a lot of triglycerides, and you'll see basically a high increase in both LDL and triglycerides. And I'm not quite sure if that would be atherosclerotic, but I'm not a huge fan of excess calorie restriction and a very kind of like crash diet approach to ketosis. I'm a bigger fan of kind of like cycling split ketosis or making sure that you're engaging in some refeeds every now and again. And then the final thing that you'd want to be careful with is insulin resistance, meaning let's say you've got high blood glucose or low insulin sensitivity due to following a high starch, high sugar diet for a long period of time. You would want to be careful because that can cause a higher total cholesterol number. And that would be something you could manage by working a lot of bitters and herbs and spices like bitter melon extract or berberine or Ceylon cinnamon or apple cider vinegar or a lot of these things that are known insulin sensitizers. So you would want to kind of include those in a ketogenic diet as well. You know, when I'm sitting down and writing a nutrition plan for someone and I've decided that a ketogenic diet is going to be right for them, I'm working in a lot of these bitters and herbs and spices. I'm working in a lot of like cyclic ketosis where there's refeed days or carbohydrate refeeds. And I'm also including a lot of plant matter, a lot of wild plants, a lot of salads and a lot of fiber because I care more about the net carbohydrate intake than the gross carbohydrate intake, for example. So those are a few of the things that I would consider. And then the final very interesting thing that I would note is the fact that in many people who adopt a ketogenic diet, their cholesterol actually drops significantly. And this is something that you can read about over on the website of Dave Feldman. It's at cholesterolcode.com. And in very active people, what can happen is as you're limiting your carbohydrate intake and your fat intake goes up, there's a lot more trafficking of fat-based energy in the form of triglycerides. And when that happens, when you're almost like burning through your fats very readily and you're a lean, active person on a ketogenic diet, sometimes you'll see what Dave refers to as the inversion pattern, an actual drop in LDL in response to high fat intake. And this is something that he even has shown on his website from, I think, over 300 people who have followed, who have been active, who have followed a high fat diet, and then also at the same time been doing a lot of exercise, and they found that this inversion pattern takes place. It's very interesting. He did a whole podcast with Peter Attia on it. I haven't seen it happen to a lot of people, but I guess it is something that happens quite a bit. So sometimes a ketogenic diet can actually lower LDL, not raise LDL, and you'll tend to see that when you're just using a lot of fats as a fuel. And you know, that's a whole discussion for another day because Dave has like a whole like podcast and website devoted to this idea of this inversion pattern in response to a ketogenic diet. So now, ultimately, those are a few things to consider, Glenn. And then, like Brock had mentioned, you know, check out your genes. Make sure that you're not one of those people who might be genetically susceptible to having any issues on a ketogenic diet. And for that, what I would do is go listen to my podcast with Kareem Denani, where we talk about genetic testing, where we talk about the specific genetic SNPs that could put you at a higher risk if you're on a ketogenic diet comprised of a lot of saturated fats. So that's where I'd start as far as that's concerned. And ultimately, long story short, is don't worry too much about the LDL, but take into consideration some of these other things that I talked about. So.
Yeah.
So there you have it.
Remember, the human is a complete organism. We're not just a walking cholesterol machine. So there's a lot of other factors to take into consideration. It's not just about the cholesterol. Do you smoke?
Absolutely.
Do you exercise? Are you overweight? All these things factor in.
Hi, Ben. My husband and I are interested in red light therapy for a variety of reasons, especially in sexual enhancement. However, he read an article that linked increased testosterone with BPH or enlarged prostate, and he has a mild BPH. So I was wondering what you think about that. Thanks for any help you can give us.
Well, I'm going to keep my response to this one pretty brief, because this is it's a myth for the most part, this idea of testosterone and even testosterone replacement therapy, not just high testosterone, exacerbating your risk for prostate cancer. And there was a whole study done on this that I can link to in the show notes that looked into this idea that one of the major risk factors associated with testosterone supplementation is its effect on the prostate. And there's been randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trials on this. They found that testosterone supplementation may cause a slight increase in prostate size. Again, not an increase in testosterone, but actual testosterone supplementation,
like
using hormone replacement therapy. Yeah, exactly. Okay. And I don't even know if they used I don't know what the form of testosterone replacement therapy that they used was, but a slight increase in prostate size and in people who already have pre-existing prostate cancer, the potential for tumor growth if you already have prostate cancer. But this is kind of like the, you know, protein causes cancer thing, mm-hmm. you know, like in the China study, it's only been shown to cause, you know, tumor growth if you already have a cancer. You know, in the case of the China study, they, I believe via some type of a toxin induced cancer in rodent models, fed them a bunch of protein and lo and behold, their cancer was deleteriously affected or their cancer became more of an issue, yeah. Right? It became a faster growing cancer, but that's not something that you need to worry about if you don't already have cancer. But testosterone replacement therapy for men who have been treated or have prostate cancer is something that should be avoided. In all other situations, there is no link between high testosterone and increased risk of prostate cancer or increased PSH. It's just a non-issue. And so it's one of those things that I think, you know, some people speculate on. It's one of those rumors that tends to fly around, but it's really not an issue, especially when you're using a lot of these natural testosterone replacement methods, you know, like the red light that she refers to, or you know, any of these other natural means. So short answer to the question, but ultimately don't worry too much. And also go listen to the recent podcast that I did on natural methods to increase your testosterone status. And I will link to that. It came out last week and I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. It was on 32 different ways to increase testosterone. So check that one out, and don't worry. Keep on pulling down your pants and shining that red light on your balls.
Don't worry. Nobody's going to look at you funny.
Only your neighbors. All right, well, what do you think? Should we give something away on the show?
Yeah, let's give some people a hat, a shirt, and a water bottle.
Cool. Well, this is the part of the show where if you've left us a review on iTunes, you hear it read on the show. And remember, going and leaving 5 stars and positive reviews on iTunes is one of the best ways to support the show. Anyways, though, if you go leave us a review and you hear it read on the show, then we will send you a handy-dandy gear pack chock full of BGF swag, or Ben Greenfield Fitness swag. And the only thing is, if you hear your review read and we're about to read the review, you need to email gear@bengreenfieldfitness.com. That's gear@bengreenfieldfitness.com with your t-shirt size. So we make sure that we don't send you a t-shirt that's going to cut off blood flow to your brain or fit you like a giant tent. So that being said, Brock, you want to take this one away?
Sure. This one's by BCL64, which sounds like a SARMS. Sounds like a peptide name, doesn't it?
Yeah,
BCL64. Sure. And the title is "There Were Many and Now There Is One." And it goes like this: I joined the throng of listeners seeking to slake our thirst for primal, ancestral, and high-tech information on how to hack, extend, and optimize our time on this rock. I downloaded and listened to many voices, and those voices were good. I like this. It's very biblical sounding. Brilliant people with a wealth of information, but cream always rises to the top. Ben Greenfield and his podcast is just that. Ben continues to amaze and deliver insights that are real, recommendations that have value and are tested by him, guinea pig that he is. And the bottom line is, folks, the information you get here is real. It's valuable. It's never ending. It's life changing. So get on board and live, love optimally. Wait. And live, love, optimally?
Yeah, I don't know.
Live, love,
either optimally. Way, I like the point where he says, I listened to many voices.
And they were good.
And those voices were good. It's like God who created the world.
And it was good.
In 7 days. And I forget how it goes. He said it was good.
Something like that.
Looked on it. So I need to go back. Apparently I need to read the Bible more.
He looked down on his creation and it was good.
It was good.
I don't know why. That was my Gandalf voice there.
Yes.
You shall not pass. Sorry.
Wow. That was epic. Yeah, I like that. I'm a little bit more of a Voldemort guy these days. I'm going through Harry Potter. Or I guess for the good wizard, it would be Dumbledore. I'm more of a Dumbledore than a Gandalf guy.
So, I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. All right. Dumbledore fans, rise up. All right, folks. Well, that's all the time we have. All the show notes are at bengreenfieldfitness.com/394, from sunscreen being the new margarine to quercetin to amino acids to the cholesterol website, the genetic testing, the 32 ways to increase testosterone podcast I did last week. We're going to link to all that in the show notes. Leave your comments. Leave your questions. We always jump in and reply. Check out the calendar so you can see where I'll be in the globe if you want to come go to some interesting events. That's at bengreenfieldfitness.com/calendar. Show notes at bengreenfieldfitness.com/394.
Woo.
And as what was the old guy named Paul who used to do radio shows? What was his name? Paul.
What?
You know what I'm talking about? Anyways, he would say, good day. Well, thanks for listening to today's show. You can grab all the show notes, the resources, pretty much everything that I mentioned over at bengreenfieldfitness.com, along with plenty of other goodies from me, including the highly helpful Ben Recommends page, which is a list of pretty much everything that I've ever recommended for hormones, sleep, digestion, fat loss, performance, and plenty more. Please also know that all the links, all the promo codes that I mentioned during this and every episode help to make this podcast happen and to generate income that enables me to keep bringing you this content every single week. So when you listen in, be sure to use the links in the show notes, use the promo codes that I generate, because that helps to float this thing and keep it coming to you each and every week.